You have a question. You
I
know
do
my
have.
rule.
Okay,
You never
so.
start a class with a student's question, because then you never get to your topic.
Wait till the end.
No, go ahead, go ahead, go ahead.
So I'm like, the alphabet, this is all new to me. And it's really interesting to hear you breaking down symbolism for one letter that has the beginning and the end, and they're same and they're different, but then they're in a sentence. And I wonder when, like Rabbi Kosman, we go to the yeshiva every morning, how do you make sense of a letter meaning something, of the word meaning something, of the sentence meaning something, and they all mean something different?
That's why they pay me the big bucks, Arlene.
You deserve it.
It's a very good question. I guess the easiest way to answer that is it's no different than when we study. I mean, obviously, it's on a much, much higher level and with infinite levels, because we're talking about God's work here. But even just on a very simplistic level, there are courses in college to study Shakespearean works. Right? I read Shakespeare and I understood it on a very simple level. And I was just translating the words, getting the basic story. But those who take it in college and they take it on a master's level, well, they're comparing why he chose this word in the same kind of context to a different word. Or sometimes, it's spelled the word honor, HONOR, and sometimes it's HONOUR. Oh, well, it's the English, right? Well, why do you use it this way? Oh, it means this deeper. And you start peeling back layers and layers of understanding of what Shakespeare perhaps meant when he chose this word over that word. In a similar vein, when we study in a yeshiva or anybody studies Torah, you first want to understand the basic, what's the message being conveyed? What happened in the story with Abraham and Sarah? What happened in the story with Moses and Miriam and Aaron in the Exodus, right? You want to understand the story. But as you study a little more and your maturity level of understanding grows, you start questioning and say, well, is there something more that's being conveyed? Sometimes the word is spelled with that letter and sometimes it's spelled without that letter. Why? So you start being conditioned to see things on multiple levels. That's really, I mean, I don't think it's unique
That's funny.
to Torah study in that way. The mind is able to understand things the more you
That's very
delve
true.
into it, the recognition of the depth of things, you start to look at it that way. So for me, I'm sure if I was half as good as you think I am, I'd really be good. But I'm just telling you honestly, honestly, when I read a passage in Torah, my first objective, what is being said? Just tell me the facts, ma'am. Let me know what's going on. Having learned for so many years, when I see the story, I'll say, but one second, I know a similar story, or I know an opposite story, or that's a word that I don't usually come across. Is there a connection between that word and the other time it's used? You start to think that way. So this is just working, I would say this is working opposite. When you first learned your alphabet, A, B, C, D, right? So you started with the basic building blocks, and then you started putting it together to form two-letter words and three-letter words and so on. This is the opposite. Most of us do, yeah, we learn the letters of the alphabet, but more just to be able to read. Because in English, the letter D versus the letter Q, there's no deeper meaning. It is just a letter. It's a consonant or a vowel. That's its depth. Not when it comes to the Hebrew letters. The Hebrew letters are more than just a letter. It represents a concept. So that when you see a word, it's not just telling you the meaning of a word, but it describes a concept that the word is trying to convey. Certainly when it comes to names, right? We've spoken about this many, many times of where a person's Hebrew name is a definition of their essence. It's not just a random name that a person was given. It's a defining aspect of the person. Now, you didn't know that when you named your child. Your parents probably didn't know the deeper meaning of its name. It's probably, you know, named for, you know, great Aunt Harriet. That's who it was. Okay, so we start with the letter H, give her a new name, and now we're moving on. But there really is truth that the Hebrew name that you have is defining your essence because that's your concept. It's pretty deep stuff. But that's the idea. When Rabbi Kosman would study in the yeshiva, I promise you, he started at step one. What is the Talmud saying? Let's try to understand. Then you delve a little deeper and you say, well, what's the ramification of that lesson? Where else do we see that lesson? Oh, how do you reconcile that? Oh, it's interesting. We use this word and not, and you start peeling back layers and layers and layers of understanding. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Amazing. Okay. Amazing.
I make it sound easy, but it takes a lot of work. Yeah, it does. Yeah. It takes a lot of work.
I get it.
I told somebody recently that I'm teaching the alphabet, and he looked at me and he says, "Really? You're teaching the alphabet?" Like, you seem to be a little bit past that stage, Rabbi. You know, like you can get someone else to teach the alphabet. I said, no, you don't understand. I have 35 classes and we're only up to the letter P. Like, what? Like, what language are you teaching?
We're slow learners.
What? It's, I find it fascinating. I mean, this is really, I presented this as an option because I wanted to learn this. You know, I mean, that's the dirty little secret here is I only offer things that either I already know or I want to learn more about. I'm not picking stuff that you want to learn. It's all about me. Okay. That being said, let's review quickly. We started the letter pay, right? Last time. And we said that the word or the letter pay, it, when it's phonetically spelled out, sounds or phonetically is related to the word peh, which means your mouth, mm-hmm. Right? And we spent some time talking about this amazing faculty of speech that God has endowed human beings with. Other creatures have forms of communication, but no creature other than a human being has the higher order level of communication and speech to be able to take an intangible thought and to express it, articulate it, so that someone else can hear it and understand it. It's a mind-boggling concept if you really think about it. How we use the mouth to speak, to convey concepts and ideas. It's a pretty amazing thing. We talked about the idea, was that a question, David?
Yes, so the question is, and for later on, so if we look at some Psalms, for example, it talks about it talks about various non-human entities speaking, right? I'll go to Psalm 148, for example, and maybe if we get later, we can.
The heavens speak your praises.
Yes.
Okay. It's not a problem. It doesn't mean that it's the communication and speech like we have. Every single creature, it's a good question. Let's take a step back, right? Arlene, this is why we don't start a class with students' questions.
Zeit Moichel.
Let's start this way. There's a basic Jewish belief, a basic concept, and that is God doesn't create something for nothing. Every single thing that has been created is for a purpose. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. It's not the godly thing to do. It must serve some function. It must serve some role in the world, in creation and in accomplishing the world, in accomplishing the mission of the world. So why I understand human beings, I understand man's interaction with creatures of the world, but how about what's the point of the star that's up there in heaven? Right up there in the sky, there's billions of stars. Okay, what's its function? Can you tell me I know they sell them for $18.99 and you can get your own star named for your birthday. I know. And there's probably a star out there with a Jewish name out there and says, oh, That's my essence. But typically, we have no clue what that particular star's function is. Yet it must have a function. Otherwise, it wouldn't be here. For God, it's almost as if every star has a name because it has a function. It has a purpose. Whatever it is, I can tell you, every creature in the world, including human beings, animals, inanimate objects, every single creature that has been created over the entire course of our history serves a function in relation to God. It doesn't exist by itself for no reason. It must have some connection with God. Remember, it can't exist if God doesn't will it to exist. It can't exist. Therefore, David, to answer your question very simply, every single thing out there in the universe communicates with God in its language. When it says that the heavens speak your praises, I can almost guarantee that it doesn't say, Moda ani lefanecha, well, you know, thank you, God, for a new day. That's reserved for us. What does it say? Good. There's a book out there called Perek Shira that describes the verse that is trying to encapsulate what that creation's relationship with God is so that it extols God's praise vis-a-vis itself. I'm using big words, but in plain, simple English, the heavens declare God's greatness in heavenly language. Rocks speak the great praise of God in rock language. Frogs do it in frog language. Whatever that is.
And Hashem is the ultimate polyglot.
And God understands all of it, obviously. Sure. Absolutely. That's really the concept that the entire universe is praising God. Because every creature has its relationship with God, and it extols God's praise in that relationship. Does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you all for joining. I'll see you next week. Okay, but the letter pay, which meant the mouth, was all about the faculty of speech, the idea of communicating. And we spent a little bit of time showing that there are times where we should be opening our mouth, the open pay. And then sometimes we should be learning to keep our mouth shut and be like the closed pay, right? We spent time on this, great. And we talked about Moshe as the perfect prototype because despite his natural inclination to keep his mouth shut, right? Because he considered himself having a speech impediment that would be unworthy of being the right leader to go speak to Pharaoh. God says to him, who do you think gives speech to the mouth in the first place, if not me? I'll be with your mouth. Don't worry. We got this. And that's exactly what happens. Tonight, I want to start really building on that concept, but as follows. You know, we talked also, one other point, and that is when we talked about the spies going into Egypt, going into the land of Israel, doing their reconnaissance mission, I pointed out to you that in the Book of Lamentations, which is the book decrying the fact that when they came back and issued their negative report about the land of Israel, the Jewish people gave up hope of going in. God got upset with us. That's the night of Tisha B'Av, right? That's why. And God says, you're crying over this? I'll give you something to cry about. Typical parent, right? So, and that's the way it's been for, unfortunately, our sad history. But I pointed out to you that in two of the three chapters that have it ordered based on the alphabet in order, in sequence, three of them have it in order, but two of them within it switch the ayin and the pay. Previous letter and our letter. Typically it's ayin and then pay. But in these two chapters, it goes aleph, bet, gimel, dalet all the way, and it puts pay before the ayin. And we pointed out that was the kernel of the crux or their mistake, is that as they put their peh, their mouth, they spoke before their ayin, their eye, before they actually saw correctly what it was. Similarly, start with the following for tonight. The reason why ayin does come before pay is because ayin meaning eye, pem meaning mouth. Think about it in terms of the Torah itself. What were we given first? The written Torah, right? That's what we call the five books of Moses. That's the Torah scroll. That what are we obligated to do with it? We're obligated to read it using your eyes. In fact, that's why the custom is, right? When the Torah reader is reading from it, they use a silver hand, right? That little pointer, right? It's because the eye needs to actually read it. That's referring to the written Torah. However, there's the whole other compendium of Torah knowledge that's known as the oral Torah, the written Torah and the oral Torah. Which came first? The ayin, the eye, the one to read the written word. Then you have the letter pei, which is the mouth, which speaks orally to give over those lessons. So again, you have it in that order. Therefore, the letter pei, again, that letter of communication makes a lot of sense that refers to the oral Torah. But here's what I want to show you. Let's look at the form of the letter itself. We didn't get a chance to do that last week. Hold on. Open this up. Here, a little bigger. Perfect. Okay, hold on. Sorry. Share screen. Here we go. Okay. Here's our pay, right? We're going to talk about this guy tonight, the first one. Okay, here's the pay. It's hard, but I'm going to ask you to really, can I do it this way? Can I make it bigger? How can I zoom this in? Here we go.
Good view.
I'm working on it. Oh, here we go. Now we're talking. Okay. Oh, now it's way off. How do I clear that? Hold on. Clear.
It just amazes me.
Okay. Here's our pay. Okay. Everybody recognize it? Nice. Okay. Here we go. But I want you to look very, very carefully inside the letter pay.
A little thing there.
Look at the white space. Do you recognize another letter?
Yeah.
Yeah. What letter?
Bet or vet.
Yeah. It's a bet.
Right.
The white space.
See all that white space that I'm filling in with blue?
No, it's not there.
It's a square one.
Yeah, coloring outside the lines.
What is that?
That's a bet.
That's a bet.
Letter bet. Here, I'm going to draw it. Goes this way, then it comes down, and then you have the base. Mm-hmm. It looks just like. Come on. Looks like this letter right here.
Yeah.
Here, see, across the top, you have a horizontal line, a vertical line down, and another horizontal. There it is. Well, now it's moved. Okay. You get the idea. Okay. Mm-hmm. What is significant of the fact that you have a bet inside the pay? And if you're, you know, paying attention, it's vice versa. If you were to write out the letter bet with a white space surrounding it, right, would be, what letter did I just draw?
Pay.
The pay.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? They have to be. If the bet is inside the pay, then the pay is out, obviously surrounding the bet.
That sounds like a song.
What? You see that? Does everybody see that? Mm-hmm. Anybody totally lost yet?
Getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, what is so significant of the fact that you have the bet inside the pay? So again, how did God create the universe? Remember, back up. The letter bet, when we talked about it, we talked about that the number two, the letter bet, which is the first letter of the Torah, Bereshit, meant everything about creation. The world in which we live, the physicality of our world, is always plurality, duality. There's nothing that's a one except for God. So in creating our universe, the bet, what form, what was the medium by which God brought the world into existence? Through the medium of?
Speech.
Therefore, it's a peh, the peh, the bet, which represents the creation of our world, bereshit, in the beginning of creating our world. Of course, it's going to be associated with the letter peh, because that was the medium by which it was brought into existence. If you really want to get technical, just kidding, if you want to at least consider it as a possibility, you can almost pretend that the letter peh, it's a face, it's a mouth. Here's the guy's nose, here's his forehead, the back, and here's his open mouth as if he's speaking. Even the form itself looks like it, like a mouth speaking, okay? Now, if you really want to explore this further, then if this is the mouth, then you know what this little piece here is?
The
tooth. The tooth sticking out of the mouth. Here's the upper part of your mouth. Here's the lower part of your mouth. And here's the tooth sticking out from the top. I'm not making this stuff up. This is way, way, way based deep in Kabbalistic concepts. But I want to share.
I'm sorry, is this the closed pay or the open one? Because I'm confused.
The open.
This is
open? Yeah. That looks closed to me. I think I missed the beginning of last one. The next, the one, this one, which one is open?
These are the two.
Yes, I see.
Right here, these two.
Right. So the one we're talking about, I thought was the closed. No, it's open?
Yes.
That's the one right here.
Yeah, I know we're talking about that one. Is that the closed or the open one?
That's the closed one.
Right, we're talking about the closed one.
Correct.
All right, just want to make sure.
Okay. That's correct. Okay.
How about that?
Okay. Fine. So let's talk about this for a moment in terms of this tooth. Why? Because the concept where we find it is as follows. And I know we've spoken about this in our class at Beth Shalom when we did the parts of the body and we spent some time on the tooth. I want to review some of this. It's really, really important. How do we grow teeth? I don't want to know the physicality of it. I want to know, are we born with teeth in our mouth already? Yes, but no, right? Thankfully, the child that's born and is nursing from its mother does not have visible teeth, okay? That grows in as the child matures. But first, it's an open or empty mouth. Then as the child matures, which again, in my language, is two steps. There's a maturity physically and there's a maturity spiritually. You're growing as a person. Anytime you talk about maturity, you have to remember we're talking two avenues of growth. So first, it's just an empty mouth. Then the child matures in wisdom. Child grows and it grows baby teeth. But then what happens?
They fall out.
And then you have another set of teeth. Think about that for a moment. If you were the engineer of the human body, would you have designed it that way? I don't think so. You probably would have designed it with no teeth in the beginning, have a little mercy on mom, and then grow your teeth and be done. Forget cavities, forget dental work, just grow those iron teeth, gold teeth, and call it a day. And it's one set. But yet that's not what the wisdom of God has. One of the major differences between baby teeth and adult teeth is the number of them. Anybody know what's the final count of adult teeth?
32.
32 is correct. 32 is correct. It's not a coincidence. In Kabbalistic literature, they talk about 32 pathways of wisdom. Interestingly enough, the number 32, which is a lamed, which was 30, and bet, which is 2, right, spells the word lave, your heart. If your heart isn't growing in life, meaning you're not improving your essence, you're not improving yourself, you're in deep trouble. It has to be 32 different pathways of wisdom. The 32 teeth represent that. Okay. Now, I want to make sure I read this right. It's not surprising, therefore, there are exactly 32 references of God's name in the chapter of creation, because it's the same concept. The idea of the peh, the mouth, with the tooth, referring to the 32 aspects of growth of wisdom, connecting, understanding in life. Of course, there'll be 32 different pathways, each one making a different reference or a veiled reference to God's name in the book of creation, in the chapter of creation. But let's dig a little deeper, because this tooth that's dangling from the top of our pay, right? What's its function? Why do we have teeth?
To help you speak.
To help you speak is definitely true. We mentioned last time there are certain letters that come from the different areas of the mouth. The teeth is one of those areas where you have to put your tongue against the teeth to pronounce it. Go ahead. What else? What's another function? To help you eat. So Jay takes it a little further, and that is the function is to chew and to grind it up. Why? Why can't you just swallow it whole?
To digest.
Ah, very good. It's because it makes it much more easy to absorb and digest and thereby discard any waste. If you take it the whole thing at once, it's much harder to do that. But again, think about it. If the teeth are that which represents the idea of amassing wisdom, then you also have to understand that the way to amass wisdom is by chewing it in small bites. You have to grind it up. I love to use this. The younger generation, Rhett, you're excluded, right? Don't understand the concept of letting something percolate. They have no idea what I'm talking about. What? Percolate? They used to make these coffee makers that it would percolate. You'd see the drop, like. Right. But in honesty, I'm talking to people who understand what I'm referring to, because that's how you have to do it. Small, bite-sized piece, chew it over. You ever hear that expression? Chew on that a little bit. Yeah, it's exactly what you have to do when it comes to wisdom. It also means you should chew on it before you say it. Remember, again, tying it back to our connection of how careful we need to be with our speech. Chew over your actions, chew over your words before and even after. Make sure you're saying it right. Make a good accounting. Am I using this to strengthen or am I using this to weaken my relationship with others? Mm-hmm. We use the term, it's so interesting, when you're having a difficult time understanding something, we use the expression, oh, he's breaking his teeth over it. You ever hear that?
I've heard cutting your teeth on it.
There is an expression, he's breaking his teeth over a difficult task or a difficult passage. I wondered about it, but now it makes a lot of sense to me, because it's not just, you don't take the task and put it in your mouth and chew on it. You have to understand it. And if you have a hard time, you got to break it down. You got to really work on this. Okay. But this applies in so many different ways. You know, where is wisdom? Let me say it the right way. Where does wisdom belong? Where does your wisdom belong? Tell me, where in your body does your wisdom belong?
Oh, brain.
In your brain, yeah. Right? Right?
Brain.
Right, Robin? Your brain.
Yes, brain.
You agree? You're in agreement?
I
don't agree at all.
In your wisdom teeth.
In your heart.
In thine lave.
In your heart. I like that. You're getting warmer.
In your soul.
Yes. Maybe that's a little colder. You got to get warmer. I'll tell you where your wisdom really belongs. It belongs in your mouth. If you don't share your wisdom, who is it serving? What good is it? You see, leaving it in your brain, Robin, is doing nobody any good. Wisdom is to be shared. How are you going to share it? Speak it. Teach it to somebody. What good is it that, okay, great. I've studied all the books. Now what? I love to give the example. There's in the New York Public Library. I don't know if it's still there. It used to be. They have one of the original Gutenberg Bibles. It's under glass case. It's fascinating, right? And I always like, so come on. What good is that book doing? It has wisdom to share with the world. So what do? We put a glass cake, a glass case over it with a lock, and we pay a guard to watch it so no one should mess with it. How about the words, I am your God who took you out? Who's telling that story? Not that book. Wisdom needs to be shared. It cannot remain just academic knowledge. Rabbi Beryl Wine once shared with us, I was in his class, I went to his high school. A great, great historian. He lives in Israel. Tremendous speaker. He told us once that wisdom that doesn't translate into an action, or wisdom that doesn't translate onto sharing with someone else and remains academic knowledge, will end up serving the wrong purpose. And the statistic he shared with us. He said the SS guard, of the Nazis, right? They were the elite group of cruelty. 37% of them had PhDs. Wow. These are not ding-dongs. These are not doofuses. 37, almost 4 out of 10 of the most notoriously wicked performing atrocities had PhDs. They had wisdom. But it didn't translate. Do you know how you can convey your wisdom? I have good news for you. For those of you who are terrified of teaching, I have great news for you. You can convey wisdom with a smile. Oh, you know, when your child, your favorite friend, when somebody does something and you want to give them a compliment, but you're just not sure how to say it, whatever it is, it's very simple. Just smile. You've conveyed so much. What you appreciate what the person did. It's a symbol of willingness to open up and share your wisdom with others. It's a glimpse of the wisdom that you have. And in the end, that's the point of the world. Because that's why God's name appears 32 times in the chapter of creation. Because it's all about sharing this wisdom.
We smile behind our masks.
Yes. The Medrash actually tells us that just as the strength of a person is held within their teeth, right? No teeth, no eat, no strength, right? So too the strength is found within the Torah. There's your connection, folks. The peh, the mouth, which is that combination of ayin peh, written Torah, oral Torah, that is meant to be the repository of all wisdom for us, it's associated with the teeth as well. And I'll show you. It goes a little bit further. We sit down, and again, we talked about this last time, that this letter pei is very much associated with what holiday? I'll give you a hint.
Passover.
Passover, very good. Pesach, right, very good. Pesach, right? We sit down at the Seder, and we're reading the Haggadah, and we read about our four children, the wise child, the wicked child, right? Simple child. The wicked child, always my favorite, always wondered, right? What do we do with this child who puts his hands on his hips and says, what is the service to you? What is the response that we give him?
Blunt his teeth.
We blunt his teeth, right? Is that the translation that you're familiar with? Hakei et shinav. It doesn't mean to knock out his teeth. By the way, there are those I have seen in print that translate it that way, and it is a terrible, terrible translation because they've mixed up a letter. The word is hakei, but it's a kuf, not a cuff. If you spell it with a cuff, it means to strike, to hit. If you spell it with a kuf, it means to weaken or blunt. Totally different translation. Anyway, what is this concept that you blunt his teeth? That means after the Seder, you get one of your nail files and you just, you know, take away this. What do you mean to blunt his teeth? It's a very strange expression. So allow me to share the following. The Arizal, the great Kabbalist, shares with us the following. As I mentioned earlier, every single thing in our universe must contain at least one element of positivity, one element of kedusha, of sanctity, its connection to God. The minute you sever all connection, you cease to exist. It's like unplugging the cord from the electrical outlet. It can't work, right? How many times I have tried, I was vacuuming and all of a sudden it stopped. And I think that, the motor busted or the roller stopped working, or and I'm start looking and looking and my kid comes in, but do you want me to plug this back in? Right? If you're not plugged in, you have, so everything, says the Arizal, must have contained within it at least one element of sanctity to exist. The Arizal tells us, and I really should talk about this when we get to the letter Shin, that the letter Shin does represent that letter of truth and sanctity. I'll give you two quick examples. Even in the wicked child, how do you say wicked in Hebrew? We call him
Rasha.
A Rasha, spelled Resh, Shin, Ayin. Those are the three letters that spell the word wicked. If you look the shin right in the middle, I'm just accept what I'm telling you for now. When we get further on, we'll maybe explain it. But the letter Shin represents that element of sanctity and holiness. If you remove that for a moment, the two letters that are left are Resh and Ayin. Well, Resh and Ayin spell Ra, which is evil. That's the essence of this dude. He's a wicked person. But the Shin is what keeps him going. Similarly, okay, in the word, I'm sure nobody here has ever done this, but we've heard stories of people that lie, okay? For a lie to exist, for a lie to even have any traction, what's the number one rule?
Has to be a little bit of truth.
That's correct. That is 100% true. There must be at least some kernel of truth. If it's so off the wall, it's not going to last. It's not. If you want a lie to last, and you do not have my permission to do this, by the way, I'm just telling you that you have to have some kernel of truth. Therefore, the word for a lie or falsehood, which represents the evilness, right, is the word sheker. Starts with the letter shin. That's the kernel of truth that will have to be to remain. Okay. There's a verse in Psalms that says, Shine Rishaim Shibarta, that you have got, you God have broken the teeth of the wicked. You have broken. Okay. Keep that in mind. It's not blunt. I'm going to draw a distinction in a minute, right? The verse says that God breaks the teeth of the wicked and ultimately they will perish. They will not survive. The commentators point out that's exactly the point. That if you break the shinayim, right, the teeth, which is the letter shin, if you remove that element of sanctity within it, there's nothing left to connect to God, and you're only left with pure ra, pure resh ayin, and pure evil. They can no longer exist to do evil. Okay, and the Talmud gives story about this. Okay, it's not surprising, therefore. What's the first creature that represented evil in the world?
Snake.
Snake. Perfect. Just out of curiosity, where does it shoot its venom from? Oh, right. Right by its teeth. Unbelievable. These things are not a coincidence, but fine. Let's get back to our child at the Seder. This wicked child. You know what? Are we really going to take out our anger on this kid? I know, I've been in the business a while. You don't get angry with people. You don't, you have to work with them. So why is the Haggadah so harsh with this kid? Blunt his teeth and tell him, man, if you were there, you would have never gotten out. Like, that's how we treat kids. Like, if you ever want to take education 101, don't read the Haggadah. Like, crazy. No. I'm totally misjudging this, because that's not what's happening. And that's why I want to share this with you. The Haggadah does not say to knock out his teeth. that would fall in line with what God will do ultimately with the wicked, and truly they will perish because they will be disconnected and have no connection to eternity, to God, to spirituality. They're gone. That can't be what we're telling our own kid. You're too far gone? No. We don't knock out his teeth. We blunt. Oh, this makes a world of difference. Do you know what that really means? Remember, his name is Russia. Resh Shin Ayin. We don't remove the shin, but what I do is I almost as if I'm going to loosen the tooth. Why? I'm going to remind him that he has a shin. He has shin, a shin. In his name is still an element of sanctity. He still has that kernel of goodness within him. I'm not writing him off, just the opposite. I'm reminding him he still has greatness within, and I am happy to work with him. I am blunting his tooth, which means I'm pointing out to him, you have teeth, my friend. You have a shin. Shin, Shane, right? Teeth. Shinayim. You still have that. It's a reminder of his inherent sanctity that lies within. However, I do warn him that if he continues to remove himself from the Jewish people and ultimately deny that inner sanctity, he will lose that shin. He will lose that opportunity, and he will become unworthy of redemption. But the point being is that I'm trying to convey to him he still has the shin. He still has the tooth that reminds us of the inner sanctity. Yes? Somewhat. Okay. You have to chew on it. Let it digest it a little bit. Let me finish with two other quick points because I didn't get to this, but it's important. The letter pay has a number too, right? So we talked about its word. We talked about its form and its design. And now we have to talk about its number. The number is 80, 80, right? You'll be noticing the pattern. We've been moving by tens. Last week, Ayin was 70. This week, pay is 80. Can you name something that's 80? This is a hard one.
Okay. Rabbi Dave?
It's at 55. That doesn't work. What else?
Rabbi Dave's age? No, sorry.
Not yet. Anybody? It's a hard one.
How long it takes to go around the world in a balloon?
Good one. Good one. The Mishnah tells us, you know, it goes through different stages of life, and at various ages, we get to a certain point. 80 is associated with the word givura, which means strength, but it does not mean physical strength, because we all can testify long before 80, we feel a certain weakening of our physical strength. But it's much more than that. The Talmud is bothered. The Talmud asks, why is it that regular people, and I say regular in quotes, the average person, as they get older, their mind unfortunately gets worse and gets weaker and less sharp. But when you find Torah scholars who continue in that path, as we've said many times, growing, challenging themselves, continuing, they stay sharp. Yes, of course, there are exceptions on both sides of the rule. But the Talmud wants to know, as a general rule, the scholars stay sharp even into their 80s and beyond. Why? And the Talmud says, because if you're continuing to grow, you're continuing to sharpen your mind, so then things get better. Because as we've said, wisdom grows, snowballs, you build on one concept onto another. And at age 80, you reach a certain level of inner strength that you're now ready to share that wisdom, even on a new level. With that introduction, can you please tell me what leader really started his mission at age 80?
Moshe.
Ah, how coincidental. Moses gets the nod from God. God comes, sees Moshe in the bullpen, and he goes, we're going with the righty now. Okay, you're up. Moshe, you're up. What do you mean? He was 79 years of age by the story of the burning bush. And he goes back to Egypt and he leads the Jewish people for 40 years. I don't know about you guys. At 80, I'm hoping to at least considered retiring. slowing down a little bit. Moshe, no. His life mission. We don't know much of the first 79 years of his life because that's not his main mission. He starts at age 80.
Wow.
Wow is right. He starts his mission of sharing. And what comes of it? The Exodus, the giving of the Torah, forging a bond with God that the Jewish people will always have. Yeah, that starts at age 80. It perhaps, and maybe it's not for tonight, but it really is a great springboard to understand the Jewish view on aging. It is not the way the world looks at it of, okay, you made it through the most important part. I guess relax and just chill as long as you can and try to enjoy. Yeah. That's not necessarily, I'm not against it. Certainly not averse to it. But if you ask the new retirees, they're going out of their mind. They've been productive for so long, you can't just flip a switch. It requires you to still keep sharp. The Jewish view on aging is, yes, of course you slow down. Do you take more time to recuperate and regenerate yours? Absolutely. And if that takes you 10 out of 12 months, go for it. But you better be growing those 2 months, folks, because that's what it's all about. Your mission. There's nobody here other than Rhett, Jay, and me. We're the young ones. Hey, Fran, you're already in the next generation. Sorry. Right? We're the youngins here. Why? Because you folks, you're only a little older than me. It's okay. Right? You still have a mission. Don't hang it up. Okay, you're retired from your job. That's fine. Don't retire from life. Life means you're still growing. Stay sharp. Chew on it. Talk. Share your wisdom with your children, your grandchildren, your neighbors. You have a skill? Teach. It doesn't have to be a formal teaching. Once a week, go volunteer when COVID is over. Go volunteer. Help the younger ones. Let them have a connection to the older generation. It's good for both of them. That's the view. 80 is not when you hang up the boots. You follow Moshe's lead. You start wearing them. That's where we're at. 80 is that representation. And I think perhaps that's why it's associated with the letter pay. Because physically, I can't run around at 80 the way I used to at 60 or 40. But my mouth, that I can share. All that wisdom of 80 years of information and knowledge and experience. Use your mouth. That's what you can share with the world. That's what Moshe did. That's what we can do. So those are your three things. It's the letter of communication, specifically with speech to express wisdom. It's the form that God used, the pay, the pad, the mouth surrounding the bays of Bereshit. It's the idea of the number 80, that point of gevura, that strength, the inner strength to share all that you've experienced in life. And don't forget your teeth. Make sure that they stay sharp. Questions?
Is there a reason that that's the first letter of periodontist?
That's a 10, man. That's a 10.
You're real. That's excellent. Yes, Fran.
So what's the deal with really the pay in reading? It has a dot in it and we pronounce it a fay without the dot. What's the story with that?
So there's a whole topic regarding dots, the nakudot, right? They're really vowels, right? So in Hebrew, it's called a dagesh, right? It does have... It's essentially the same letter, and it has essentially the same meaning. There is a nuance of difference, but to really appreciate it, you have to know what the nekudot are in general. So we're going to get through all the letters. We're going to get through the final letters, because there's at least one class that we have to lump the five final letters with a message. And I hope that we'll have at least one class on all the vowels, which are dots and lines and squiggles. Yeah, They also represent things. It's interesting. The three dots that we call, it's a segol. Okay? What letter is that? What color is that?
Purple.
Come on, you Ravens fans. Right? Segol. Why does a three dots? Hold on. We'll get there. I hope.
Anything we should know about the form of the final pay?
Yes, but I'm not, I don't have it clear in my head.
Okay.
I have a little bit, but I'm not ready.
Okay.
Wait, there is something to it. What, Liz?
So the dot that makes a bet a vet and a pay a fay, those are considered vowels, or are they a separate category of symbol?
Then yes. You have to wait, Liz. Pay attention.
But he gave a little bit, and I thought he was calling them all vowels. So I.
It was a tease.
Yes. I'll put it this way. It, in my mind, it really is acting as a grammatical symbol. But that's really what these vowels are in Hebrew. Right. They're grammatical symbols.
Okay.
We don't think about that because in English, we differentiate between a vowel and a consonant, but they're both letters. In Hebrew, there's no such thing. Letters are letters. Vowels / grammatical, those are a separate category.
So they're all symbols that affect the sound that the letter makes.
And it may change a meaning. Correct.
I was going to say, they're also the conjugation as well. That's correct. The point.
Yeah. And it also puts, it also gives an indication of where to put an emphasis and on which syllable.
Okay.
They play multiple roles.
Okay.
It's not like in English where it's a letter, it's just a vowel. It represents something about the grammar of the letter and the word. And it can change depending on where it is. Sometimes there's one of the hardest things in the Hebrew language is there, I think, Jay, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are an equal number of exceptions as there are of the rule. It's really close.
Yeah.
Every rule has at least a bunch of exceptions. It's like the wildest thing. So typically, for using your example, Liz, in the beginning of a word, I would have said 100% of the time you'd have the dot and it would start with a bet, like bereshit. It's not veration, but I'm wrong because there are exceptions to the rule of where I know there are words in Tanakh that start with a vet. Why? Welcome to grammar.
Okay. Right.
In modern Hebrew, it doesn't usually run that way, but in Tanakh Hebrew, absolutely.
Correct.
Absolutely.
In modern Hebrew, in regular spoken Ivrit, I can't think of an example. It's almost always follows the rule, start with a bet. Yeah, Robin.
Yeah, just really quick. So the open and the closed pay, you were talking more about the closed one, but the open one sort of also has a little bit of tooth, the way it goes down and hook. Everything pretty much apply to that also?
It's the same message. Whether your mouth is open or closed, the tooth represents that concept of wisdom. Sometimes you have to hold back your wisdom. It's another conversation, but very simply put, one of the greatest lessons I learned as a teacher is your job is not to teach everything you know. It's to teach enough that your students can gather it. Sometimes, properly, a teacher has to hold back a little bit, not say everything. I sometimes cross that line and I hit overload on you guys and I can see, woo! Right. I get it. But that's, yeah, sometimes you have to know when to keep your mouth shut and hold on to the wisdom until the student is ready.
There's a little feather inside the pay. Does that have meaning? I'm assuming it does because nothing's an accident.
There's a
feather. That's the uvula?
Oh, this? Oh. Hold on.
That's what makes it the bays inside.
It is. Yeah. You're talking about this little guy?
Yeah.
Yes.
About that.
I don't know. I'm going to look.
Otherwise, it will be a cough.
I'm just curious if that is. Hold on. Stay there 1 second.
What do you mean, Fran, it would be a cough?
If that right side line was straight and it didn't have that little indentation, the internal would look like a cough. It would just be like a.
It makes the inside.
It makes the bed. It helps form the bed.
But she's right. No, but Liz, you're right. This is a little more flowery than it really is in the Torah. There is a little indentation in that middle part of the vertical line. I won't do it justice, but it
has to be there to make it a base.
Yes, but there must be something to it. There's a book. I don't have it. I'm not a sofer. I'm not a scribe. So my knowledge base of exactly how the letters are written to that degree it's not my thing. But I know that there's at least one book that is super, super, super detail oriented about every nuance about the lettering. And it's, I'll ask one of my scribe friends. I'll have to ask them. I don't know.
It could be the tongue, could be the uvula.
Could be.
Could be a cavity.
Cavity. My book doesn't even have it.
I'm thinking more
it.
It's in the back of the throat. It's more like the tonsils, but okay, yeah.
Mine doesn't even have it.
Right, yeah. Yeah, a lot of the letters don't even have it.
Yours are very rounded, and that's what you have is not, that's like block lettering.
Right.
You know, that's in English.
That's what it's
a block letter. And there's nothing wrong with it. But the letters I'm showing you, I tried to find one that tried to capture the way it actually is written in the Torah with the line and the squiggle and the crown. Maybe it's not the best one, but there is something to that, Liz. I don't know.
Okay. And ours says Fay. It doesn't say Pay.
Well, there's two. The one with the dot is Pay.
Pay. But I'm right. And then Fay.
The one without it is Fay.
Right. And then the final Fay.
Final Fay, correct.
Right. Okay. I was hearing it Pay. Sorry. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We're good.
Interesting now. Every time you say this, I'm thinking about wisdom teeth, you know, like why they.
Yeah. I'm telling you, there's a method to this madness, folks. There really is.
But we always pull our wisdom teeth.
Right.
Yeah. You can't handle the truth. No, okay.